In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Daniel, thanks for taking over the title thing. I was scared all night about that. Thank you so much. As you said, the name of this title session actually today is What If Russia Wins? And let's try to first understand the situation a little bit better. And you all were reading the news during the weekend, probably. And given the latest peace plan discussions that are happening right now, including proposed territorial concessions, potential no NATO clause, and so on. Question to both of you. Has Russia won already this weekend? Karimas.
Again, thank you. Thank you for having me. Great to be back in Munich. So, the question, has Russia won? I think no, and it will not win. I think what's happening with the so-called peace plan, and I think we've seen it over the weekend. It was a bit of a shock to a lot of Europeans here that, you know, this just came out seemingly out of nowhere. I think knowing how President Trump's administration works now, and by now we've had that, he's been in power, what is it, almost a year now? He's been elected a year ago. So I think we should be able to understand how President Trump works. He potentially allowed Steve Witkoff to talk to Kirill Dmitriev, and they just kind of started talking about it. But honestly, I think that the broader trend, what we see now, is a lot more encouraging. So first of all, we see U.S. Congress, which is absolutely an essential element in the United States political structure, but also within the society. These are the representatives that represent all of America. I think I get to go there probably every month, every 6 weeks to meet the congressmen and senators in my capacity as a member of parliament. And we see a lot of support for Ukraine and no support for Russia. And I think at the end of the day, whatever, you know, President Trump wants to get some sort of deal. He wants that deal signed, right? And call it peace. You know, I think key element is here, is it going to be a durable peace? You know, probably not if it's sort of imposed peace. Now, with the latest, what's happening, I think, you know, whether it's the NATO clause, you mentioned NATO clause, mentioned many other things, everything's on the table. In my opinion, in my assessment, nothing's going to happen. This will go nowhere. But that's my intuition. That now, because if you take one or two clauses from that 28-point plan, it doesn't work for Putin. And to be honestly, the whole 28 points and probably 25 points don't work for Zelensky, for the Ukrainian people. So I think at the end of the day, we're going to get to some sort of havoc where we'll be kind of talking about this for another week. I know the self-imposed deadline by President Trump is Thanksgiving, the 27th of November. But honestly, at the end of the day, we're not going to go anywhere without continue to squeeze Russia on energy, on economy, on trade, and providing military support to Ukraine. So I think it's a lot of noise about things that not going to pan out. But that's just my assessment. You know, I hope that deal could be done, but what we've seen in the past, I think it's just very hard to see that this can actually move forward.
Karimas, you just talked about perception Lithuania. Kai, you were chief of staff of Eurocorps. For those who might not know, it's a multinational European corps involving 11 nations. You've been in other deployments before where you were with more than 24 nations involved. When we look, so you have had soldiers from 11 nations working in your corps. Is this perception everywhere the same? Because if I look at media and so on, I always hear from a European perception. Is this European perception really there?
If I look at it from the military side, and that's the first effort I want to make, is generally, yes, we have a common perception. And the background has to be explained a little bit. I think everybody recognizes, and this is where the common ground of that perception is, everybody recognizes that through the Russian attack on the Ukraine, it has become more evident how the security environment globally has changed. We have multiple actors that are rivaling each other, and the Russian attack on the Ukraine has brought out that there is a certain amount of coalition building already taking place. And in the midst of it are the United States. We can come back to that later on. But that has changed, and we're talking today about trying to extend spheres of influence, not to say imperialism, a new way. That's the first part. The second part, I think, that has a common ground is that we see that this puts a test to our alliance as well as to the EU. Who are we as Europe in this struggle? And I think that's realized by everybody and it has a strategic implication. The third element, which is also common ground, is that the breadth and the brutality of the war that has become evident shows us that we as the military have an awful part to play in the defense, but that we cannot do it alone. And if we look at security today, we cannot look at it just from a military perspective. Those are, in principle, the basic commonalities. And that has led in NATO to the development of common plans. And by the way, that is since the general defense plans of the Cold War, the first time that that has been done. And everybody has signed off on it. Everybody in the military is aware, and this is a key issue, we need to be capable and strong enough to fight in order to avoid having to go to war. And that is for us key. But if we need to go, we need to be able to win it. And that struggle is one that we not only look at it from a military perspective, but also from a more comprehensive issue. And we know that in today's situation, we can basically rephrase what German Chief of Defense and the Minister of Defense have said. We are not really at war, but we're also not at peace anymore.
Sie haben nichts gelöscht. Sie haben nichts verboten. Sie haben einfach entschieden, was sichtbar ist. Du konntest sagen, was du willst, nur hat es niemand mehr gehört. Denn Öffentlichkeit war kein Ort mehr, sondern ein Algorithmus, ein Filter, ein System. Democracy Down ist ein Roman über das leise Ende der Demokratie. Ein Journalist erkennt, dass es nicht die Gewalt ist, die die Wahrheit auslöscht, sondern die Struktur. Was wir sehen, was wir teilen, was wir glauben. Alles ist manipulierbar. Nicht irgendwann, sondern jetzt. Democracy Down von Daniel Fürck. Ein Thriller über Sprache als Waffe und Demokratie als Opfer. Jetzt verfügbar. Überall, wo es Bücher gibt.
That's pretty interesting because it brings again the point back to society, right? And Hridimas, I would like to ask you, you've entered politics in 2017, before you've been in banking, before you've been in the military. Since 2017, how have public sentiment, attitudes, and the whole society changed in your country?
Well, I'd say sadly, unfortunately, you know, we have been right about Russia for many, many decades, right? We've been saying that all along, kind of, you know, saying, and, you know, it's not, I wish we were not right in a way, but that's driven by centuries of experience of living under those regimes. So I think in our country, and I think it's across the Baltic states, like Poland, and the whole frontier of NATO and European Union, I think we see that the threat assessments are aligned of what, you know, what we're facing. Now, that's that threat assessment then drives a clear-eyed approach to what we need to do about, you know, about Russia, about also not just Russia, by the way, it's also the Belarus, which is kind of a vassal state of Russia. Then we can talk about kind of the whole axis of, you know, axis of evil or whatever we call those, Iran and China. And it's sort of mix and match situation there. But I think with the society is very, very much clear. So we have very much aligned on the kind of foreign policy, security, defense policy, because the threat is so right in staring in our faces. Now, of course, we realize that that the world is changing dramatically, and it's not only because America's role is changing. I think it's very easy to blame it on America, that because we see U.S. news every day, we see, you know, the TVs, the movies, because it's always been that kind of the most free country, that the popular culture we see, we live those lives almost in a way. But things are changing. The China's dominance in economy, the global South, the rise of the kind of big giants there in Brazil and India. So there's a lot going on in this world. And I would echo General's question. You know, where are we in Europe? What are we as Europe now anymore? Brussels used to be that center that was kind of, it used to have like a pull factor. Everything revolved around Brussels. But I think nowadays, if you look at the political landscape in each country, and I think we need to be looking at each and every country and see the rise of forces that don't necessarily believe in the power of Brussels. Right or wrong, it's not for me to judge. But the whole point is that the people, the populations, so Europe is, I would say, we're still moving towards more fragmentation than unity. Now, what can unite Europe? And I think threat risks, that's the sort of things that actually unite Europe. And I think here we see, you know, we need strong leadership. And here I also wanted to say, you know, to commend really the German Bundeswehr and your political leadership really for agreeing to deploy that brigade, the 45th Panzer Brigade, to Lithuania, which we're very much grateful, and we're investing together in that, in both in infrastructure and abilities. I think it demonstrates, you know, to the German forces that they can do these sort of operations. It demonstrates to NATO that, you know, NATO can actually deliver these sort of capabilities. It also demonstrates to Russia that, you know, NATO is not asleep. And I think NATO, you know, both on the defense plans, but also if you look at geographically, we have never been stronger. Really, continue to invest in defense massively. We're going to double as an alliance defense spending in the near future. Finland, Sweden joined. Defense plans, as the general said, are absolutely, you know, a novelty. But it's not a novelty. It's a living document that will be, you know, based by the real forces. So, a lot of good things are happening. But also, you know, it's obviously a volatile world.
I may want to add something, because it is necessary to address this. These perceptions that the individual countries have, of course, differ a bit. And you mentioned it. And what we have to acknowledge is that the threat does not come alone from Russia. And when I talk about Russia, I'm talking about the territory of Russia. And NATO is orienting rightly on a 360 degrees azimuth to cover potentially everything. This is also the result of different perceptions that we have in NATO. A Spaniard sees a threat far more from his countercoast coming than from Russia. And that has to do with the proximity. However, we need to find a common agreement to balance how do we respond to those threats with what means. And these means differ. And the key piece that we also need to take into account, and I just read an article today that there is turmoil in France because the chief of defense has addressed the issue of the mental state of the population as to security and defense. And I think we can cover threats only if our societies follow along with the respective threats. And the recognition that there is something that definitely may affect our the way we live. And hence, that is something we can look at it from a military perspective and political perspective and have all the agreements. The actual way to respond to it takes more than just those two pillars.
Hey, Dimas, you were mentioning that it's not in your country a political or also cultural developments since Krim, for example, but that it's since decades. So what can we Western Europeans, for example, learn from your country concerning building up resilience?
Well, I think it's always hard to, when you look into your own country, it's always, you tend to be more, I mean, in a national setting, I'd like to say great things about it. But, you know, when you're an insider, you're like, oh, there's so much more we could do, you know.
You can also talk about the region.
No, but it's, you know, it's one thing is, again, those decades spent under the kind of Russian and then the Soviet, you know, oppression do develop certain mindsets. I think we're always, people are always very, very careful with what's coming, kind of any good news is always being scrutinized, and whether it's regarding Ukraine or regarding, you know, even that we are coming from Russia, that's something that's positive to us. No, we always, you know, I think we tend to recheck that. But on overall, I think that the question what we're talking about is the so-called societal resilience, which is, again, we're a rather small country with 2.8 million people. In a way, it is easier to manage probably than much larger question, the much larger countries. But there are certain elements that we, you know, and when I was served as a deputy defense minister, we had to kind of set up the system for resilience. And it comes in several elements. First of all, resilience, like what are we, who's in charge? This is something, when we talk about resilience, it sounds flaky, because resilience, yes, your ability to withstand any sort of negative shock to your society, whether it's COVID or a war or some other incidents, accidents. Now, but it's really about who is in charge, who's sort of the czar of resilience. And when I was at NATO, and I remember we set up the resilience committee, and the question was like, when you reach out to every ally, who's going to represent that resilience file from your country? And to be honest, it cannot be a Minister of Defense, because it's not just a military thing. It cannot be Minister of Interior, because it's not just an interior security issue. It's not, cannot be Foreign Affairs. It cannot be many other. It should be somebody who works at a kind of whole of government approach. I know it sounds sexy, whole of government approach, but how hard is it to do? Honestly, it's a sort of a prime ministerial job, level of job, because you have to deputy prime minister or some sort of job that it has someone who has that authority to really tell different ministries to do their job.
And who is it in Lithuania? Sorry. Who is it in Lithuania?
Well, in Lithuania, we have probably national security advisor under the president's office. Again, that's one other option. In the U.S., this is the same way. Back in our day, was Jake Sullivan. Now it's probably, I don't know who's the national security advisor. It's Rubio now, right? he holds three jobs right now, four jobs. Anyway, but the whole point is we have to think about it not in a siloed way, but really at a whole of government approach. How are you going to deal with this kind of resilience questions? And I think another thing is it's a long-term investment. It takes time to invest in sort of resilience, and whether it be infrastructure or digital infrastructure or disinformation or kind of hybrid warfare, countering hybrid warfare, and there's so much more. I mean, it can be anything really, resilience. So the whole point is that we need to invest in education, we need to invest in certain infrastructure, in certain, you know, cyber tools, really build those institutions, and it does take time. It's not a quick process. So again, I think we're all kind of trying to get it right in terms of how to build societal resilience in every country. But I think it's okay to miss sometimes. But as long as we kind of move forward, that's what's important.
Kai, towards you, when we talk about resilience and independency, a lot of times we nowadays in Europe talking about also being less dependent on the United States and becoming more European together and so on. From a military perspective, are we achieving this right now? Where do we stand?
It's It's a challenging question.
Your last day at the army. You can be completely open today.
No,
right?
No. I have a clear perception on this. The first thing I think, when we come to the terminology European independence, I think that is a misleading terminology. If we talk about less reliance on the United States, that is more proper, because from my perspective, the transatlantic relationship remains, for not only our but also for the United States security, an essential pillar. And while political messaging may point from some perspectives into a different direction, the hard belief by many experts is still, without the transatlantic relationship, we give in to other actors. It is key. The core question is, what capabilities do we have? And there, I will not repeat what can be read, what capabilities we are lacking. The key pieces we have realized, we need to go and do something about it. And I would like to address three issues, I think, that need to be messaged to any adversary that are key. For one, NATO has started to conduct consolidated plans and defines from the plans the capabilities that are required. That is the first time since the Cold War since we have done that. So whatever we need drives what needs to be produced, drives the demands. The second piece is that takes money. The German government has taken in Europe a significant lead in saying we, as the central nation, have to point out we need to do something. And we need to give a clear message to everybody, notwithstanding that the Baltic nations and Poland have already raised their defense budgets over years beyond the average of what NATO wanted to achieve. But that message was the second one that was important. And the third one that was important is, we will raise the necessary forces, the human capital that is necessary, not, and this is what I want to emphasize, not to go to war, but to avoid a war, to deter anybody from moving that way. Now, that will take a while. However, here again, we have to build a relationship, because of course, nobody can build capabilities from today where you call for it and have it on the plate tomorrow. It takes time. So one of the issues that needs to be discussed with the United States, who has not made a final decision on the force posture yet, how can we go into a transition process where the United States is able to withdraw forces and we can bring in these capabilities ourselves? And by the way, this discussion always gets a negative notation in Europe, but we have to take into account the United States, as one of the major power players in this world, has different directions to respond to. And I think it is a clear message and not one that has been very new to say Europe is able and needs to take more responsible for its own defense. I've conducted for 5 years the defense planning for the Baltic states and northeastern Poland. And the one key message that we always had to sell is, it is European nations that will be the forces of the first hour. It's not going to be the United States.
Will there be a European army?
Pardon me?
Will there be a European army, as construct as every day felt like on news?
That's a question that goes along with what we have in place. As we grow our capabilities, we do that within a set framework. And NATO is a long-existing, most successful alliance that is structured multinationally. We have agreed standards. We have agreed training principles. And that is the tool from which we should work. Now, as we proceed into the new assessment of our security environment, the European pillar within NATO will grow. It will have to grow. And I think everybody is fully aware of that. The European Union is the institution that can, in support, do a lot with regard to defense financing, defense procurement, because what we need to be better at is in Europe to consolidate the resources that we have available. Not each nation doing their own, because the sum of what the nations bring together does not equate if Europe would consolidate and focus on what capabilities do we need to build together that becomes far more efficient and allows far easier to comply to standards and to achieve effectiveness and readiness. So I would say that we should not go down into a discussion that we do not have to lead at that time, because we have the tool that is accepted and that has been most successful over the past 70 years.
All that comes down to political will, of course, in the end. And Khedimus, a question to you as the politician here in the round then. Kai was mentioning before, as Benyard might see the situation a bit differently or has different priorities than somebody from Eastern Europe. We have elections coming up in France. We might not know which party is winning. Czech Republic has recent elections, which with a party in the end being successful, that is not in favor of supporting Ukraine. So the question to you would be then, are we currently as Europe enoughly united to build up this resilience and to act as one part?
I think if we remember the February of 2022 when the war started, it started actually 2014, but when the active phase, the wide scale invasion started, I think this was one of the most, and I was at NATO back then, this was the most unifying events that we've ever had. Like, we're all spoken with one voice. We're going to support Ukraine until victory and all those things. You know, lots of words, lots of politicians. We can say strong words of support. Now, eventually, and by the way, this was right after the kind of the polarization and fragmentation that COVID has brought upon a lot of our societies, which really continues to kind of, I think, to affect overall kind of a grassroots level societies. Now, I think unfortunately, the unity that we had at that during those first days of war and the first months of war is unfortunately slowly dissipating. But that's really a responsibility also of political leaders. But we have to understand, if you live in democracy, if you are unable to deliver on certain things, there's always going to be elements that will arise and they will bring another message, unfortunately. A much more sometimes even violent, sometimes unacceptable message to others, really creating even more polarization. So I think it's, you know, that's why the European project, I think, really we need that leadership. We need leadership from big, strong countries. We need to invest in defense to build up that capability that, you know, that Kai was talking about. You know, I think it's having that force that Europe really becomes, you know, a force, a global power. The world has changed to such a degree that in this world, we're, you know, the word is peace through strength. We're back into the Ronald Reagan kind of time frame. You know, we all want peace, but we need to have strength. If you don't have strength, you're not at the table. And we see that, by the way, at the negotiating table around the questions of Ukraine. Europeans are not invited or just sort of skipped or just sidelined, you know, whatever the word is. But, you know, the countries with the biggest, you know, the muscles, the military muscles, are deciding on what's happening in the world. And if we want that, we need to, and of course, the best to do it as Europe. But that is so hard. That is so hard. In every country, there's a defense industry that's going to be kind of pushing towards its own interest. And it's understandable also because our taxes are going up. Because we're going to spend a lot more on defense. Now, of course, we want to make sure that money circulates in each and every economy in Europe. On the other hand, we want a united approach. We want to, you know, it's sort of an impossible, it's also an impossible question to resolve. But I think there's no other way. We have to, you know, strength delivers peace. Not the other way, not any other way. If you're weak, you're going to be used by people like Putin and others. And I think in here also I'd like to agree with Kaida, the transatlantic relationship remains the cornerstone of our security, despite some of the things that President Trump's administration has been saying. Always going to say we're very much supportive of President Trump. I think he has good intentions. He's got a good intuition also on various foreign policy matters. And by the way, during his first term, when I served as Deputy Defense Minister, we actually negotiated their troop arrival to Lithuania back then. And now the posture review that's sort of ongoing at the moment is going to be determining a lot of these things. But I think, again, U.S. presence is absolutely essential, because the future wars, I guarantee, if something's happening in the Pacific, U.S. is not going to be alone. If something's happening here, we're not going to be alone. I think we're still a values-based transatlantic alliance, and we're going to stay that way. So, and the Congress agrees with that, and the American people agree with that. So,
gentlemen, we have 1 minute left. Daniel is already on our toes. So let's finish the round with a little, small, quick answer, either or session. Chidimas, I will start with you. Building resilience, top-down or bottom-up?
Properly work has to be bottom up, but you have to have top down authority as well. But bottom up has to be there.
Guy, I think I know your answer already. Military capabilities, national focus, or a combined European approach?
We definitely have to become a team Europe.
Nice. Chidimas, European strategy towards Russia, diplomacy or authority?
You see, when we have diplomacy without authority, we get that we're being eaten at the table. We're a meal at the table. To decide things, you want to have diplomacy that's based on with authority. That means with strength and power.
Kai, how to become resilient? Is it a personal initiative? That's a pretty hard word for a German. A personal initiative, or is it reliance on the state?
If we want to build resilience, it has to come from the individual. So individual initiative is essential. Without it, no resilience.
And my last question is going to both of you. Your personal standpoint in the current times, also with the news of last weekend, optimist or realist?
I'm a politician. You have to be an optimist, because that's why if you don't project a positive, optimistic future for the people, they're not going to vote for you, right? So I'm an optimist.
Kai.
I think we have to be realistic in our assessments, but we should not always be pessimist then in the results, but also see what has been evolving. So I would call myself an optimistic realist.
Let's go for the optimistic overall. And thanks a lot for your time. And over to you, Daniel.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.